We're back today with Ari Huitolar. Ari is a joyful, thoughtful, considerate presence in improv worldwide. He's originally from Indonesia, but now resides in Norway, where he was part of founding Improv Nu, which we talk a little bit about in this episode. He's got some great observations on coming into an improv scene, even the global one, with an Asian perspective. The explosion of access for participation and opportunities to see improv from different contexts throughout Asia is something to celebrate, and I know Ari has a passion to see improv spread further throughout the region. In his own quiet, unassuming way, Ari has been a big factor in building bridges across different communities. As much as I enjoy his thinking and enthusiasm for improv, as I thought back over the year, I can see a lot of his fingerprints on the increasing connectedness of improv. So with that, let's get into the Ari Huitolar episode on the Improv Comedy Connection. I look back over our interactions, which started not long after the quarantine. And at that time, I was doing the summit with a whole bunch of people from all over the place. And you also wrote something on improv in the third world, or access to improv. And I kind of went back to that, and that was a really good piece, and I thought that would be kind of interesting to reflect back on that.
The fact that these places can only have access to improv when you have like random improvisers passing by,
right?
Instead of being a hub where a lot of traffic comes in.
Yeah. So when you ended up starting, that was when you were starting to study in Europe and in Holland in particular?
That's right. So when I started my PhD in Netherlands, I needed something to get away from the science. So right. It was a balance between science and improv. Science in the day and nighttime is like loosening up with the improv. But I've always learned improv from a European perspective.
So when you were growing up, did you grow up just in Indonesia or did you move around? Because your dad was or is a politician, right?
He is a political commentator.
Oh, okay.
He's a political observer in Indonesia, which also that means he is in the politics himself.
Okay.
He was the most political he was a spokesperson for the president of Indonesia.
Okay. And when was that? When you were a kid or after?
That was when I was already a teenager, close to 20.
Did you do any kind of theater or anything like that growing up at all or no?
No, I've never been in the arts at all. I've grown up more of a sports person.
Yeah.
Doing tennis and basketball and stuff, and thought that arts is not within my capacity. I can understand a lot of comedy because I was watching a lot of Whose Line Improv, for instance.
Okay.
But I was not in theater or anything.
Yeah. So Whose Line was showing in Indonesia?
Oh, it was showing in Malaysia. I'm one of the privileged families which is able to get a satellite to peek into our neighboring countries like Malaysia and Philippines, and they get some programs we don't have. And they had Whose Line. I remember it was Tuesday afternoon, and it really caught my attention. I wasn't so much into theater, but like Whose Line, particularly Whose Line, feels like a cleverness folded into theater. It's my thing.
Yeah. Did you end up seeking it out then when you were like in Holland, in the Netherlands, because of Whose Line, or what got you to even look at it?
What happened was I thought improv is an art for the gods, which is not for us mortals, right? There was no access to it. But in the Netherlands, I was in what you can call a Dutch party.
Okay.
And with a lot of smoke in the air. And then one person was saying, yeah, we're doing improv. And that was the first time I thought, oh, someone can do improv outside of these four guys doing it in Whose Line.
Yeah.
And I went there. They had these shows, weekly shows, in a little in a little pub.
And then you got kind of asked to either take a class or start doing it with them, or
well, it was a small group, so they needed to get more and more people, right? I became a groupie. I was the one who prepared myself for great suggestions coming into these Wednesday shows and shouting it out, and also becoming the kind of aficionados that sits back and listens while other people give normal suggestion and I'll give a clever one.
Right. Yeah.
I was very arrogant back then. And then they asked me to help them out with the tech part, like the editing the scenes and providing a little music for the
like
scenes.
Light cues or closeouts of the scene or whatever.
Right, light cues and closeout music. And that also teaches me about the beat of a scene when a scene is about to end.
Yeah, and that's not something that everybody can pick up. Because we've done training, like if we're at a show, because we usually travel around, and back in when we were able to do more of this or any of it, we would sometimes say, okay, here's how the sound cues work, and you think you're very clear, and then someone just all of a sudden throws in a music cue 30 seconds into the scene for no reason.
I start to sit back on that tech booth, just deconstructing the scene that, okay, there's this one, this played enough, but this seems to be the beat. And then also, I mean, learning by failing, by thinking this scene is doing really well. I'll just keep them playing on, and they're like fish on land trying to survive. And I'm there, oh, I should have edited earlier.
You know, one of the things I've appreciated about you, Ari, is that you also do, you write some thoughts down along the way. And one of the things that I tripped over just in kind of looking back was an article on 2-minute scenes or 2.37 minute scenes as being kind of the magical moment. And I think there is something to that where, you know, edits would happen kind of within that time, or that might be a typical scene game in a short form kind of thing, but it's different online, isn't it?
It's definitely different online. It feels that things develop a little bit slower in many things. I can't pinpoint why it is. Maybe it's because people can't establish so much at the same time, so they need to take a little bit more turns, watch out for each other, and also I think it's also an artistic choice, because now you have this choice. Because before, it was always, when you're doing improv, you're doing 2-minute scenes in a workshops, you're having a very small part in an improv show, right, when you're beginning, so you need to get out there fast. And now suddenly everyone has a capacity to create their own theaters,
right?
And they can play it slower. A lot of people seem to enjoy that, playing slower.
Yeah. I think time also just feels different online as well. I don't know if it's because you don't have all the drive or the, you know, the public transportation to the theater, and then you got your slot and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you may still have a start time for your scene, but you don't have all that run up. That's it's just not there anymore.
Yeah, definitely. There's also less of a interactive audience that you feel you need to please right away. So it can be both a plus and a minus. For veteran improvisers, when you remove the audience, it feels that they're in limbo. There's no feedback. But for younger players, it removes the pressure of them to entertain people.
I have felt, though, that when there is a larger audience online, that you somehow feel them. I don't know if you feel that at all. Do you?
Yeah, you can have these shows in the Philippines last week where you had 78 people watching at the same time. Even though you can't see them, you see just this number, 78. It makes you feel more like a performance to a mass of people.
And things coming in the chat box or just sort of the suggestions or an LOL somehow is affirming and keeps you going in a little different energy boost.
If people typing hi ha, that don't realize how much it is a boon for the improvisers right. to give them validation of the scene.
Now, I think I saw this. I think you put up a post that was something to the effect like you would be happy if it was just online improv from here on out.
That's right.
Yeah. Is that true? Yeah.
It's more of a trend for me to discover, right?
Yeah.
So I feel I've done a lot of in-person improv. I mean, not as much as real professionals do, but I've done it for 15 years and I learned here and there, whereas online improv is still territory that's still ripe for discovery. Mm-hmm. I feel that each day on online improv, you're discovering something new that you do at a higher rate than in-person improv.
What do you mean a higher rate? What do you mean by that?
You mean that you figure out how you can make scenes better earlier. I mean, in the beginning, it was maybe more about tech issues. How do you not step on each other's toes? And then later on, how do you do framing of yourself on camera? But mm-hmm. I think there's also a different kind of beats to the form that you are learning that, you can take something from in-person improv, but it transform into something else in online. Like you say, it may be slower, for instance. It might be more deeper. It might be more genuine and less comedic, for instance. Mm-hmm. So these kind of tools you develop every time you do an online show, online workshop, for me at least, much more per session than I do in person.
Mm. Well, and also you're playing with different people more often than you were when it's in person and you're, where your primary opportunity is your home theater or home troupe, team, ensemble, whatever, and festivals here and there or whatever. And you have been doing the 10-minute scenes around the world and have a nice map going. How many countries are you up to in terms of performers you've worked with?
It's 55 now.
Okay.
55 countries. I've worked with 150, 160 improvisers around the world.
And what's been the main points of learning do you think you've gotten out of that experience?
I think in the beginning it was connecting with Asian improvisers is that we can use the references, some shared references of where I grew up, because I grew up for 20 plus years in Indonesia.
Yeah,
I have a set of experiences that I haven't used on in-person improv in Europe. So mm-hmm. the first thing when I do with Asian improvisers is I can use these references as a way to connect.
Mm-hmm. Right?
It's less of about making joke about the references, but it's more about finding something in common. I think when you play in person in your own home theater, there's a certain code, sort of certain like codification of how you do improv in your theater that mm-hmm. makes you connected to other improvisers near you.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you play worldwide, you have to figure out what is your connection to this other person.
Right.
Not just like the style of improv, but like where in the world you are. How do you do status? How do you do interactions? Mm-hmm. How fast you speak?
Mm-hmm.
So I might be speaking to a native English speaker in Asia, and I can just, and they would speak faster than I do, or I might be speaking to someone who is less fluent than English, and I need to calm down, slow down, and let us find a common tempo.
Mm-hmm.
So it is really about trying to find what connects us.
The countries and cultures within Asia, obviously there's a ton of variation, but the shared references that you're talking about that you're able to use, explore, Are they independent of that, or do you think it's there is more of an openness to certain types of references because you're not in a European, North American kind of context?
I think there's, for instance, power dynamics is quite different. Familial relationships are quite different. So if you're playing family scenes in Asia, you would notice this is not just Indonesia and Southeast Asia, but I think quite around Asia. Mm-hmm. If you're playing a father and son scene, you would see that mm-hmm. the father has a more higher status than they would in Europe. Mm-hmm. They would have a bigger say in the scene.
Relative to the son or daughter character is what you're saying. Right.
Yeah. Right. So the son or daughter character would be less rebellious, I think, in Asia than it is in Europe. And mm-hmm. then other things that are shared, for instance, power dynamics. I think in Europe, we get so much scenes about prison. And then why is that? Why is prison so interesting? Why do you get prison? I think it's because of power dynamics. It's very clear power dynamics in prison, between a prison guard and a prisoner. I think for Europeans, that's the way you can tap into what is a high status, low status kind of thing. Or you can do king, peasant, yeah? But in Asia, you have these power dynamics in more mundane things. It doesn't have to be a prison. I think for us, a power dynamics happen in a government office. I can imagine myself just like waiting for my driver's license and the government officer has all the power. That scene wouldn't be the same in Europe.
In Indonesia, do I understand this right? There are separate languages based on status?
That's right.
So tell me about that. I'm very interested in that because that notion is kind of mind-boggling for me.
So first of all, Indonesia itself has 600 different languages. It's one of the most diverse linguistically country in the world.
Yeah.
And I'm zoning into Javanese language.
Is that the largest language group or no?
It's the most influential, I would say, in Indonesia, because a lot of the political and economic dominance of the country is in Java.
Right.
It's in the island of Java, specifically Jakarta. Jakarta is in Java.
Yes, right, okay.
And Javanese has this thing about you have language tiers. So you mm-hmm. can imagine for people thinking about Spanish, you have tú and usted, tú being informal, usted being formal. But you only have that word for saying you. Now in Javanese, you have this kind of tiering system for every word. So if you say eating, informally it would be dahar. If it's polite, it would be mangan.
And very different. It's
very different. For see, it's not just like little different inflections. It's completely different word.
Yeah.
And it depends on who you're talking to. So if you're talking to your grandmother, you would be using a different vocabulary than you do speaking to your buddies or speaking to a house staff in your own house. So whenever people meet in Indonesia speaking Javanese, they start off sort of figuring out where you are, which language I should even speak to. Yeah. Sometimes they would just go for a bit more mid-form and then figure out, oh, this person is my boss's cousin. And then you just like very sneakily change your entire vocabulary during the conversation.
Okay. And you just learn how to navigate that. And like you said, sort of modify your linguistic choices.
Right.
In the conversation, you mix the two languages almost.
Yeah, you mix. Sometimes you talk to someone with these words in that language, and then you get reply on a lower tier.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny that you have this conversation. They're not using the same words, but they understand what's going on. So there's like an implicit exchange there, right? You don't even need to say it.
Right. So that obviously has some very definite like behavioral responses, I guess, to figuring out where you are in whatever the status structure is that you're in, right? Do you think it is a different experience in a European context, for instance? There's just not as many behavioral cues that get that, because I feel like there is sort of often kind of a sizing up or trying to figure out like where, you know, who you are in relationship to each other. Or do you think status is just very different in the cultures?
I think it is very different. I think even in Europe, or if I can extrapolate to American, you do have some kind of sizing up where you are.
Right.
But it's a more even ground between people. I remember when I was still living in Indonesia as a kid, we traveled to UK. And then one of the sites I saw was a very distinguished gentleman in a suit sitting next to like a street thug. And they were just chatting. And to me, that struck me a lot, because you won't have this kind of interactions in Indonesia. You would just like stay away. But in UK or in Europe, they can still have somewhat of an even ground to speak on. So, there's definitely that.
Yeah, interesting. So when you, as someone who grew up where you did, are performing in a European context, do you feel like that aspect of your life was just not accessible to you in scenes? Was it kind of shut out from what you could do?
Yeah, it definitely felt it was not being used at all.
Yeah.
So it is as if you've learned these kind of social codes throughout your life, and then you come to an environment where they don't use the social code. So this knowledge is sort of stored away. So I didn't feel I have access to play that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I play with other Asian players, even in Europe, I could feel like I can untap it a little bit.
Yeah.
And now I can play anywhere in the world. Feels like opening a Pandora's box of lived experiences.
When you teach on, I think I've seen you use sort of the Eastern and Western cultural contexts. Are you also finding ways to open up that dynamic for, we'll just say loosely, Western performers as well? And if so, how do you do that, and how's it worked?
So I would highlight it for them to see that these things happen without them realizing it. So for instance, in one of these workshops, I put four people on sort of sharing monologues, taking turns doing monologues. Whenever they get inspired, they speak out. And then after a while, I stopped it and say, just notice the power dynamics. These Western players are doing more of the space, because they feel it's not about being steamroller or about being selfish in this space. Not at all. It's about Eastern players being more timid in not saying anything until they say something of importance. Because I think this is a part in growing up in Asia, that you're just a minor piece of the collective, that you, when you speak out, it has to be something that's of note.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. So this carries over. And when I highlighted this thing, give the space to the Eastern players first and see what happens, suddenly the scenes that happen out of these discussions change by a lot. So we had like these chats that move into scenes, without any sort of intervention, you would see the same scenes you would see in Europe.
Yeah.
But once you become more aware and give the other people more space, then the scenes become more diverse.
Yeah. So more diverse. And would you also characterize the scenes differently in other ways?
In what way you mean?
Well, so you said that before this, like, mid check-in kind of thing, that you were seeing scenes that were very much like the scenes you would see in a European improv context, but that afterwards they were different. And maybe what I'm asking is how they were diverse. You know, what were the characteristics of the scenes post mid check-in as opposed to before?
So even this, something as small as scene painting can affect a lot of things. So we're there to describe a school, what is there in the school, etc. And then you get the stuff that you know in the school. But yeah, when you share, you know, when you give space to Indonesians, what I say was, in my school, there's always like this big bird on the wall. That's the national emblem.
Okay.
That shines patriotism. And
okay,
that reminds you of school kids having this kind of patriotism ingrained in us in class.
Right.
And when you play that scene, suddenly it becomes different, right? So it becomes less of a Hollywood type of classroom scene, but it's a different kind of set of students.
Yeah, it's less. I like Omar Galvan. I don't know that he uses it in this way, but he talks about improv karaoke, which is a copy of a copy in some ways. And if you're copying the schoolroom scene from a movie you've seen, that's not your experience as opposed to the classroom that has the bird on the wall, which now you're in that space and that's what's inspiring you, as opposed to some classroom in Los Angeles.
That's a brilliant analogy, because I think now I can understand what I'm trying to do is that when Asian players try to learn improv, they try to learn improv that has been developed in the West. So they also thought you would need to copy this, the references, the stylistic culture. And what I'm trying to do is making them closer to their actual experience. So instead of doing the, what did Omar Galvan, like a copy
karaoke?
A karaoke. Instead, be confident to bring what they lived onto the scene.
Yeah. I don't know if this is accurate or not, but getting back to the status differences and maybe relating to people stepping forward more, is status something that Westerners, just to go back to that sort of dichotomy, that they seek to grab and establish, whereas in an Eastern context, you're just trying to figure out where you land. Do you think that's part of it or no?
I don't think Western players necessarily try to grab it.
Yeah.
If anything, it was the Asian players who would be grabbing it. They would be the one, okay, we have a scene. Who is going to lead the scene? Who's going to captain the scene? So you would actually see some players in Asia that is more aggressive in trying to get that high status because it felt like someone needs to be it.
Okay.
And all quite often the senior improviser says like, okay, I'll take it. Right.
Right. But that's once you've jumped into the scene though.
Right.
Right. But before you even jump up for a monologue, is that difference? I'm not fighting for this position. I'm just trying to unpack it, to, you know, because I do think you said the Asian players, once they felt they had more space or however you might, you know, describe that, that's when they were stepping forward more and the references started to come more from personal experience. And that is certainly a lot of I think the improv world is realizing, how much there wasn't space for certain voices, perspectives, or whatever on so many different layers. And this is one that you're describing on an international context.
Right. So it feels Eastern players might have like an extra step to step forward in these kind of shared monologues. So let's say a Western player, they are sharing monologues about personal stories, right? And then, oh, that reminds me about this time I was in Bremen or something. And then they can already just go into their personal experiences. When I was in Bremen, I had like this big sausage. It's a really nice sausages in Bremen, by the way. Whereas,
figured, it took us a while to get to anything food related.
Feels like for Eastern players, you need to establish the arena first. Like, okay, I have a personal story, but I need to give you context what the life is like in Hong Kong, what life is like in Malaysia before I can tell my personal story based upon that.
Is that because the assumption is that the other player is not going to have a clue as to that context?
Correct. Yeah, I think that is.
So you're trying to be helpful, right? You're trying to be helpful to the other player, whereas maybe, and this would be a note for the quote unquote Western player to not just assume that everybody knows about this sausage in Bremen or whatever it is.
So, what happens? I think when Western players give these things, that is a cultural thing that is thought to be already known, and then Asian players don't know it. What they do, they just shut up. They're like, I guess I should know that. Whereas Asian players say, okay, this is the life in Malaysia. It's like this, and they sort of like put it out there for other people's like. Is that really so? Then they have to sort of like defend this position. Yeah. And then am I representing my culture well? Am I speaking out for, so there's a lot of things going on while setting up the table. Right. Yeah. So that is just like this, it can be a minor, it can be a major hurdle, but even the minor hurdles gives you like a half a beat, a split second to stay away.
You know, when we move, you mentioned the technology of going online and trying to figure that out. And I remember that experience where we were working out our show format, and looking back early on, it's just how distracting this other thing to worry about was. And once you had it figured out, then you were more free to improvise. And then we started doing some themed shows, for lack of a better word, and you had to know that theming well enough, and it was another point of distraction. These cultural, not kind of either knowing if you have space or like how to navigate those kinds of things is all pulling away from you being able to be present.
Absolutely.
Right, which makes the experience less. So you used a term, and I guess I'm not sure that I've brought it up yet or that you did, but a cultural check-in at the beginning of a workshop or a show or any kind of interaction before, you know, the improv happens. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so a cultural check-in is just a going around the room and hearing out where people are from. And I think people often take this part sort of like very trivially, that, or they use it as, hey, our workshop has 15 countries, and just sort of like leave that aside. So it's just like a number. But I think when you do a cultural check-in, just like let people just talk a little bit, like, what is it like over there? What do you like? Okay, again, another food references, like, what is a favorite dessert in your country? Even just like that thing already puts other people in the room to be aware, like, oh, there's these things. The scenes, our scenes can take place in a Hong Kong dim sum restaurant, just because we hear that So it is sort of like removing one of this small hurdle about setting up the place so that people from Asia or lesser known cultures don't have the obstacle of, okay, I'm going to come into the scene. I have to set up, this is the world and this mm-hmm. is my scene. Mm-hmm. The part about where the world part, you do it in a cultural check-in.
That gives people an opportunity to individually be seen, I think, and that also gives them maybe the ability to put something of their own out in front of everybody else, which I would think would make it easier to put something of their own out in a scene too, or a monologue or what have you, right?
Absolutely.
Is that something that you do every time you have a, we'll just call it an international or multicultural event or class?
Well, it depends on what workshops I'm teaching and the composition okay. I'm teaching and the size of the teaching.
Yeah.
You don't want that entire workshop just to be talking about this part.
Yeah.
But there are some very cultural sensitive workshops that I'm leading, like East-West or East-West statuses, that requires more time to unpack this, like establish points in the world. At the very least, if you see the map as empty before,
right?
After you do some check-ins, everyone has in their mind little dots on the map, on the world map.
Yes.
And then that already gears them to, we might be in one of these dots.
Okay.
Right. Some workshops that are more focused on technical things about improv, I might not do that so much. Mm-hmm. If I'm do a workshop on game, for instance, I don't need to go into cultural too much.
Although I suppose if you find that you are noticing that some people are not participating at the same level, that might be a cue for someone to say, maybe we need to do one of those mid-cultural check-ins where we thought we didn't need it at the beginning.
Right.
So when you look at the influences, at least the ones that you've listed, and as you described earlier, I mean, they come from primarily the North American context, it seems to me. Obviously, some folks in Europe as well. But the influencers that you reference are primarily U.S. and Canada based and a little U.K. How much of that is limiting? I don't mean for you personally, but just sort of that improv does tend to source a lot from these types of sources and influences. Mm-hmm. And if there was a different source available to you, how different do you think improv might be for you? Does that question too big or make sense?
I need to unpack it a little bit. Yeah, I understand. So I'm learning improv from a lot of North American teachers. Mm-hmm. And for the longest time, I'm taking both the tools and the ingredients.
Yes.
The ingredients being the culture. And I think that what I'm now realizing is I only need to take the tools of mm-hmm. improv, but the ingredients, I'm going to source it to my local products. So this is going into food thing again.
Yes.
Right. So,
yeah, right.
it's like a Singaporean chef going to France, learning mm-hmm. French cuisine. And then coming back to Singapore, what he brings back is how to do sous vide, how to do different kind mm-hmm. of culinary techniques. But then he's going to fold in the local ingredients into it.
But if all you use, though, are Western cooking tools, there are some recipes that you just can't accomplish, too. So I guess maybe the question is, you know, do we need the mortar and pestle? Do we need the wok more than the saucepan, or whatever it is? So what's missing from the improv kitchen?
I've been watching Indian improv and, for instance, playback theater with Lakshmi Priya and Abhishek Desai. And then when I watched them, I noticed that there are these tools that I'm not familiar of. I okay. want to know more of, and how they deal with statuses, for instance, how they have these kind of dynamics. So these are the things that I want to learn a little bit more by interacting with Indian improvisers, Asian improvisers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the tools, but also the walks.
So what would you describe as the new tools that you saw on display?
It's about it's about status. It's about how much space you are giving to other players. It's like how much
space, like physical space,
or scene space.
Scene space, okay.
Dialogue space, scene space, impact space. How much you can dabble the scene.
Yeah.
How much influence you have in the scene. And I think what they had there about just like jostling for the space in a different dance that I'm used to was very amazing.
Okay.
So it felt that it's not just an ingredient. That felt like a new tool.
Yeah.
That I could bring.
And that tool could be used anywhere.
That tool can be used anywhere.
But you have to understand it and how to employ it, right?
right.
Yeah, because if you don't know what a sous vide cooker does, you just plug it in and then like, I don't know what to do with this. Better put some water in it, right?
I don't know what this thing does. It keeps burning off
right.
without the water.
Another little thing. There's so many little pieces, Ari, that I feel like you just kind of throw out there. I don't know if you know how rich your thinking is, at least to me anyways, on improv. And so I just feel like I've got this list of things that I'm throwing at you. You know, tell me a little bit more about this nugget from you. But another thing that came to mind, and I didn't follow up with you on it, but I was really interested in it. You talked about the different types of accents in English that people have as having an effect on their experience. So much of international improv is being done in English. So that's non-native for, you know, many, many people. But can you share a little bit more about what you were thinking or getting at with that notion?
Yeah, I think growing up in Indonesia, that is a part of life in Indonesia as well. Like, how much accents you have on your English can determine your social status, social standings. Yeah. We sort of look up on people who has no accents, like basically speaking American accent. They say like, oh, you must be a very global person and have a higher standing. So yeah. I think that carries into improv in some ways. For instance, I quite often coach people from India, and I would first ask them, what feedback do you give to themselves? And then they would say, I've fudged up this grammar. Mm-hmm. I didn't use mm-hmm. the perfect tenses. I choose the wrong word. And that really ties into the competency about the language being a competency of the player they are.
Yeah.
And I think that should be avoided.
Like, right.
How well you are an improviser doesn't depend on how well your mastery of English is.
Yeah, because the reason it came to mind is I won't say who they were, but I had a couple of conversations with some Asian improvisers who were just sharing about something, and then there was this apology for the language. You know, like you were describing, you know, like it's the wrong tense, or I'm just no good at that. And one said that someone kind of criticized their language, English, as being too base or too coarse or too low, or, you know, whatever it was. And I'm understanding them just fine. And just it seemed like there was almost this over-expected sense of relief when you took that away. So I guess part of my question is that it seemed to me like that might be an important sensitivity particularly for native English speakers, to be aware of about the impact that someone may have when they're treading into, you know, their non-first language.
Mm-hmm. When someone is more fluent in their English, it also makes them more confident in taking space and then making the others sort of like, okay, I'm just going to move back a little bit.
Right.
So
right.
You have to be aware of it. So I'm trying to untangle these aspect about mastery of language versus improv. I do a workshop that is called Bad Shakespeare. And okay. that is trying to, that anyone can do Shakespeare with their understanding of English, even from basic English to actual Shakespearean English.
Yeah.
And try to like make these two things different. Shakespeare being about playing characters, about playing roles, and about the importance of words, mm-hmm. rather than the mastery of words itself. So you mm-hmm. can say just bus, which is a basic word, but if you put importance in it, you are a Shakespearean, even with the basic English.
Okay, yes. Deliver it with all it's the about, force you can muster, right?
Right. And I think it struck upon some people that, oh, that's very interesting and eye-opening that you can do this. It's not about the mastery of the language.
How about the access to improv? Can we go back to that a little bit? I think there certainly is a lot more access that an individual improviser can have to people all over the place, all over the globe. That's why you have 50 some countries on your map of improvisers you've done scenes with. But there is still an aspect of, I don't know, limited access on a broader level, because, you know, if you go back to your childhood, if you weren't in a family that had the ability to have a satellite dish, you wouldn't have known about Whose Line. So even if you had gone to university in the Netherlands, maybe you wouldn't have thought to go to that improv show, right?
It's so brilliant callback, by the way.
So what would be the importance to you about seeing improv more accessible to people who might not have that privilege? Or I guess in part of my question is improv just too privileged in and of itself because it's such a leisure thing as opposed to it, maybe it should be more an art of the people, if that makes sense, than it has been. That is another one of my patented, overly long questions. But I'd like to hear your answer.
I didn't have access to improv when I was growing up in Indonesia. Right. And even now, if you see my map of improvisers, Indonesia is still blank. I still have not found anyone in Indonesia that does improv. Oh. And so one aspect is the language. It seems like all the countries that has improv are the ones that I can access, that I can reach out to, has some English in their component. That's why you see India and Philippines being the forerunners in improv in Asia. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And not, for instance, China or Japan. So so that language is one of them, that you can have like these interactions more when you have the English as something that's already built in. So when I say like you need this access, it's like, so what happens to these 300 million people of Indonesia? Their voices are not on an improv scene yet.
Right.
This may be just only me. I'm like the only Indonesian improviser I know, trying to represent 300 million people now.
Right.
Right. So,
but you're not a cultural ambassador. You don't have to be, right?
Right. I only represent myself.
Yeah.
But yeah. So all these are still not represented, And even though you see some countries might have a lot of improvisers, it's still not in, built into the grassroots of all layers of society like you would in the US, for instance. I think improv in Southeast Asia would be only for the privileged class. So there's still voices of the underprivileged that has not been brought up into an improv scene.
Right. And I think we, if you don't, then obviously you're missing part of the human experience and a significant part.
Right. So it is still the stages of theater where the theater is all about the kings and the royal court. Right. And we don't have the stories of the people yet, of the of the common people.
This is a weird connection, but I was thinking about this topic and it occurred to me that one of the things that I think is so fascinating about Pompeii is that you have this frozen in time experience that included the common person, as opposed to history just being written by those who had the ability to have the education to write down and the status to have their writings passed down. And this is a time where, because of how much more information is available, how much we can record things, that expansion, I think, just it's disruptive in a good way, I think.
Pompeii, yeah, that's very early on, and they would already have a...
I think it was like 70-some AD or 100 AD, somewhere in there, you know.
And it already captures not just the stories of the senators, but also tradesmen, craftsmen, and other people in the society.
Yeah.
So it's interesting when you see improv now, it's still at least in Asia, you still see it and as being the privileged one. So when I'm zooming in with players in US, they're often like college students in a just like their bedroom playing that. And then I play with some players in Asia and then I realize like, oh, these are the lady of the manor doing improv. You would see some of the house staff who going behind the one doing the improv.
Mm-hmm.
So the class is still limited to some person in Asia.
But you have to figure out where you locate. So my question is, what impact do grid cell attractor networks have in our ability to locate our status?
That's an amazing aside. That's my neuroscience background.
Yes, I know it is. And I kind of wonder, I mean, I've heard you talk about how you try to keep those things separate. But to me, that's like learning how we figure out where we are in space. Is that an accurate way to describe what that topic is?
Yeah, so they're moving on to neuroscience. Grid cells are these cells that allows you to know where you are in space, your orientation. And that is survival, right? You need to know where you are, so you need to know where to run if the predator comes in. You need to know where you are to find food. And why people are very interested in that field is because where you are also gives a lot of memories. So this part of the hippocampus deals about both where you are in the world and the memories attached to that world. Yeah. So calling back into the shared monologue, when you place a scene painting and then you place yourself, okay, we are in this space, a school with a bird, with a national bird on it, it carries a different kind of set of memories attached to it.
That's in some ways, I think ties back to Spolin and the importance of location being more heightened than I feel like is always given its due in other traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how much of it is because of that sort of, because that's baseline, you know, the simpler brain activity, not that it's simple, that drives those memories and those attachments, right? It's kind of basic humanity.
It's basic, not just humanity, it's basic mammalian brain.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
So just to understand the envelope here.
Yeah.
So it reminds me, I was listening to these audiobooks about world history while I'm walking around in from home to office.
Yeah.
And then there was like this part about World War II as I was passing by a kindergarten.
Okay.
And and somehow those, because the part of the brain that process where you are and the memories are the same part of the brain, it attaches them together. It sticks them together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there was moments where I was, I don't know, months later, I was walking and I passed the kindergarten suddenly. Oh my God, Normandy, Normandy, Normandy. And then I realized, oh, what's going on?
I think, though, that's pretty, and I hope you don't mind my bringing it up, because I feel like there is something to understanding how our brains work, that if we can be aware of it, those that like that connection somehow in a scene, maybe that's why callbacks are effective in a lot of ways, because now it's like, I was there, I remember that, it's Normandy again, right?
Right.
have you learned anything you know, else in your studies and your, you know, your quote-unquote day job that you feel is informative to the improv world, or no?
Oh man, I keep getting these questions from neuroscientists. So what does improv bring you to science? And then from improvisers, what do the neuroscience of the brain tell us about improv? And you know, like I said, I try to like keep them apart. But I think that's true, that there's like connections between them. Like this, what we have in neuroscience is called the Hebbian network. So it means that you have a brain that is like hundreds of millions of neurons, and then you have like these smaller networks. What happens is that if some neurons start to build a network that is very strong to each other, and then if you fire a couple of the neurons down enough, suddenly all the pattern starts to complete. And so that's what happens in improv as well. And if you touch upon this, suddenly it gets you call back. If I think what we're trying to do is like how to activate these callbacks with just a few, well, with fewer push up the neurons.
Yeah.
But that's what's doing in the brain. It's Hebbian networks.
So, I don't know that you mind kind of connecting those two worlds or not, but, you know, sometimes you're just going to get asked about these things, but I dug a little bit into what you were actually studying and thought, well, that's pretty interesting. Not that I could unpack it all, but, I'm glad I figured a little bit of it out. All right. Well, as maybe sort of, as we kind of close out our time, I'm wondering if you were to start over, or if you were to talk to somebody who was just starting out in improv, where would you send them first? Not necessarily to a person or a school, but like, what would you say would be the healthiest or most productive or whatever place to start in an improv journey?
I'm biased. I would say send them to Improneur, my community in Oslo.
Why don't you stop there though? tell me what is the core of Improneur?
Inclusivity. So being inclusive to everyone of different backgrounds, different styles, different languages, and so on. So I think why Improv is healthy that way is because it's a collective of minds. So even though I started teaching some of the core teachers there, Improv is built such that everyone grabs their own knowledge and have like what is a representation of improv for them.
Yeah.
And then when someone comes into the community, they see that, oh, you can do improv in a myriad of ways. Hopefully it's not confusing. So it might be at some point it might be in the beginning, it's there's not like a code book, this is how you do improv. Mm-hmm. But people are understanding that there's a different ways of having fun.
Yeah.
Because a lot of all these teachers, what their core is this. This is what I think is fun. This is what I think is fun. And this is what I think is fun. And then if you're a new improviser, you come in and then it's not about like following a certain set of rules, but like, oh, emphasis on fun here and here and here and here. It's when you reach to the next level, then you start to try to understand a little bit more about the rules behind it, getting a little bit more technical. But usually in the first year in Improv, you would like just focus on just like having fun in a different ways. Every workshop has a different emphasis. That's what we are still trying to do in Oslo workshops online, is mm-hmm. give a different set of menus on like different ways you can have fun. Because if you have like a more set curriculum, that might get yeah. you launch you very fast in the beginning, but you might also get a bit more
uniformity.
Beelining sort of, and not find okay. your own identity.
So fun is a core value in addition to inclusivity, but fun is a core component of at least the introductory aspects. Is that also a core to what might be described as advanced coursework as well?
So yeah, I think in advanced level, people start to have less fun sometimes,
yeah,
right? And they're focusing on some techniques. So when that happens, I say like go back to the fun. It's like if you're finding these things very hard, just take a break, or even better, go back to level, join a level one, and just like see how much people are having fun in there. I have a lot of people who's already in level three, who find way more joy in level one.
Well, we've talked about this on the podcast before a number of times about the special joyfulness that comes from the quote unquote 101 show. Mm-hmm. There's just an energy. There's a freedom. You don't know you're doing it wrong because you don't know enough to know that this is supposedly wrong. But those shows are a lot of fun, I think, because of that. But if the goal is to be, if it is a craft, then to really hone those skills is going to require some refinement that will not always be fun, right?
That's right. That's right.
So there's, I guess, another goal for those extra levels then, right? Or you would do the additional levels in a different way.
I would do the advanced coursework in yeah, all the refinement. But so you do all this refinement, and then in the beginning all this refinement is fun because you're learning. But then
yeah,
refinement sort of saturates, and then you get a little bit edgy.
Yeah.
Why am I yeah. not improving? And that's when you should relax, go back to the fun until you find the right. joy again, and then you pick it up again and try to include these
right.
things, include the refinements.
Yeah, kind of go and play in the backyard instead of feeling like you've got to play on the national stadium whatever your sport is or whatever. So,
but I think yeah, there's a lot of sometimes a built-in that you always need to constantly improve because your friends are moving on, you know, they are getting, and then you're fighting for stage time, that you feel this pressure that you always need to sharpen yourself all the time.
But that's one advantage of online.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one advantage right. of online, because, yeah, there's no issue with stage time, really. I do think there is a special energy that comes from creating your own show, format, ensemble, whatever it is. I mean, you've experienced that, right? And mm-hmm. What do you feel... What's the benefit to you as the person who pushed it forward, who founded this theater? Why did you choose to do it?
Why did I choose to do it?
Yeah, yeah.
to be more sustainable at first. So it was more a selfish goal. So I used to be just like an improv troupe, hoping to get the audience come in week after week after week. Have to cancel some shows where whenever there's less audience than the performers, you sort of okay, that's not the
that was the rule.
So when I restarted improv in Norway, one of my goal is sort of build something that's sustainable. So you build your audience by building them into players as well, and mm-hmm. and then they get folded in into the mix. You get folded in, and then you become a theater. And over mm-hmm. time, I think my goal shifted from wanting to be the star on the stage and having fanboys come week after week. Instead, I found my place might be I'm not really a star. I'm just hoping that other people find their ways. Yeah. And surpass me. Many of them have surpassed me.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the reasons why I'm a fanboy of you, Ari, that you have sought to push others forward and you celebrate their success and appreciate your thinking and your learning and getting to know you. And I appreciate you sharing some time on the podcast here.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you so much. With such such reflective questions that you have, and that what a curveball to neuroscience that was. That felt like a bridge to a song, and now we can go back to the chorus of improv.
Right, there we go.
Thank you so much.
That's Ari. Although we covered a lot, there's a lot more that we could have gotten into. If you want to explore what Ari might have to say and share, check out the links at the episode webpage at improvcomedyconnection.com. I wanted to highlight the connection between the openness of the stage to personal offers and experiences. If improv is too homogenized, it is very easy to understand how someone without a plain vanilla context for that experience might hang back and draw from their second-hand observations of a context other than their own. Whether innocent or not, that somewhat stifling environment impacts the ability to put yourself out there, and that's a key element to good art and also the best comedy. But it takes thoughtfulness and consideration to change that environment. The cultural check-in, or any number of check-ins for other purposes, can be a really good tool to get people to that point of safety and confidence to share more of themselves. Again, there's a lot more to Ari than we got to. In addition to the episode webpage, you can also track down his articles on improv on Medium, and he's put up a lot of good content there. And while you're surfing around, would you pass along this podcast to a friend and rate and subscribe on your podcast platform? Let me know if you're getting what you'd like out of these episodes by sending me an email at wit@improvcomedyconnection.com. I really have appreciated connecting with listeners from all over the world as I'm doing this to be of help to you as we work together to connect more deeply with each other and our audiences through comedy. As always, thanks for letting me be your host. My name again is Whit Schiller, and I'm an improviser out of Milwaukee with Fishsticks Comedy. You can find us at fishstickscomedy.com, and you can connect with me on social media at Whit Schiller on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening to the Improv Comedy Connection.